Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Fire echoes through our show today. You're going to meet in a few minutes the author of the new Pulitzer Prize-winning biography, Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder. But first, we're going to start with the fires burning here in the Northwest. Well, the sunrises are beautiful. That's the best I can say for skies right now. All the smoke you see is unhealthy for some people, unsettling for the rest of us. So we want to know, why is the smoke here? Is this the new normal for Puget Sound summers? And what can you do? Here with answers to that and other questions are climate scientist Sim Larkin, a research meteorologist for the U.S. Forest Service. Welcome, Sim.
Hi, nice to be here.
Thank you. And from the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency, Eric Saganich. Welcome, Eric.
Hi, thanks.
First of all, Sim, where is all this smoke coming from?
This smoke is coming from a variety of places, depending on which day you're talking about. But most recently, we've seen a lot of smoke coming down from Canada, from BC fires into Seattle, and that's probably likely to continue for a little bit.
BC, and what are there also, is there fire smoke getting sucked in from eastern Washington, too?
Right, yeah, we have a variety of fires on eastern Washington that's also, looks like we get some more smoke coming that way even this morning, tomorrow morning.
And why is the smoke lingering so much? Is it just a lack of wind?
Well, there's a lack of wind, but we also have this high pressure setup that's really pushing a lot of that smoke down. I don't know if you remember last week, we've had a lot of upper level smoke. We just enjoyed the sunsets, but the air quality was clean down here. So now, you know, our upstairs ceiling basically collapsed and all the smoke's coming down here.
Eric, am I wrong that the last few years have been the smokiest in Seattle ever?
We've had a variety of impacts. Like last summer, we had a lot of wildfire smoke.
Yeah.
And that, at that point, from our records, was the highest summer impacts that we've had. We also get a lot of high wintertime fine particles, actually from wood smoke from home heating. And so, interestingly, you know, they're actually comparable levels, but what we're seeing now, and it's during the day and people are outside and more active, they actually notice it more, whereas in the wintertime, it's dark, people aren't outside, they don't actually notice it every time.
Yeah, that's true. And how about air quality? How bad is this air quality compared to recent years?
Yeah, well, right now, levels are unhealthy for sensitive groups, and so it's really important for those that are sensitive to air pollution, and this has been significant, and, you know, we've saw similar levels last summer, but before that, we've had occasionally maybe one day or two from wildfires in the last decade that you could notice to this degree, but you know, it's been pretty interesting summer, to say the least.
Sensitive groups means asthma.
Yeah, if you have a chronic lung condition like asthma or a chronic cough, or there's also people who have heart conditions, actually, this is really important because those fine particles that are in the smoke can cause heart attacks, can cause stroke. There's decades of literature now that demonstrates that, you know, these are causal and important.
We actually see statistically the increases in heart attacks and strokes when it gets like this, smoky, and stays like this?
Right, for wildfire smoke and from other types of pollution when they have levels this high.
Sim, a listener named Deirdre wants to know, is this the new normal for August in Washington?
I think that's a hard question to say yes to, although the answer really is that what we're seeing now is what we're likely to see for the next while, at least according to how the climate models project out into the future. We're in a transition phase with fuels on the ground and with our climate patterns shifting, and we don't know exactly where that's headed at this point. So defining a new normal may be a little bit premature, but what we're seeing these days seems likely to continue for the foreseeable future.
Likely to continue for the foreseeable future. Okay. By the way, we'll take your questions on Twitter, too. We are at KUOW. Let's talk about the fuel on the ground. Is that the biggest cause for the increase? First of all, I don't want to assume. Sometimes I feel something has changed or I feel how much it's changed, but I'm wrong. So just the fire, the forest fire, the wildfire situation in the Pacific Northwest is like what now compared to the last 5 years and then beyond, you know, beyond in the past?
Well, we're seeing fuels as dry as we've ever seen fuels on the ground in the Northwest and actually down into Oregon and California as well. So these conditions, some of the large fuels out there on the ground are comparable to kiln drying. Dried fuel. So they're extremely flammable at this point, making the wildfire conditions quite, wildfire behavior quite, quite severe.
And we have, do we have extra fuel? Because the winter summer actually was, at least the early, early spring, it seemed like it was pretty typically wet. So you, at least typical. So you got plenty of early growth.
That's more of a factor in areas with extremely light fuels like grasslands, things like that, where you need the water in order to grow new fuels. With the fuel conditions we're seeing right now, they're really quite dry, and so the question about moisture in the spring isn't as much of a factor for those.
Is fire suppression play a role over the last century in some of this, and is it coming to a point where we really are getting more impacted from it?
Well, we know that fire suppression led to a buildup of higher than previous levels of fuels on the ground, and that those have played into wildfires and the amount of emissions that have been put out.
Fire suppression meaning putting out fires that could be
Correct.
Allowed to burn more, protecting people, but losing more,
right.
thinning out more growth.
And here we're talking about historical policies, really, that were ended a while ago but still have legacies on the ground. Nowadays, we have much more advanced systems for judging when to suppress fires, et cetera, but we're still dealing with legacy fuels buildup. We do a bunch of there are a bunch of techniques out there for trying to deal with those, including prescribed burns and things of those nature. But enacting that and bringing us back to quote-unquote natural conditions is something that's a long-term project.
Sim Larkin is a research meteorologist for the U.S. Forest Service, and also with us, Eric Saganich with the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency on a day when the air is anything but clean. Sim, is it too soon to put all of this on climate change as opposed to a more short-term weather cycle?
Well, this is one of the difficulties we face, is that climate is really talking about the likelihood of various aspects of weather to occur. And what we're seeing right now are a number of cases where weather that's was fairly unlikely to occur has occurred in sequence. We're seeing years when the temperatures are quite high, for example. And so you can only really speak probabilistically with respect to climate, but what we're seeing is matches our expectations for climate change.
Eric, we have some questions from listeners about what to do, how to breathe. On Twitter, Savannah asks, without AC, is there anything I can do to protect my cat and baby chicks? My cat was hoarse this morning. I suppose we could talk about humans, too. Any tips?
That's hard. This applies to humans, too. If you can't find another place to bring your baby chicks and cat, that could be problematic. We usually recommend for humans to go to a store, go to the shopping mall, go to the library, somewhere that you can find a place that you can have closed windows and doors and stay cool enough. Maybe a Petco would welcome some pets while they're shopping. But I'm not certain if I could think of any other resources in that realm right now.
Okay, go to the library, go to the store. When we're at the store, maybe we could purchase something. On Twitter, Will asks, should we all start wearing masks and which type?
That's an option. And again, we're forecasting levels for sensitive groups that can be impactful. So, if you're a healthy adult, you can potentially get by, especially if the levels really do drop tonight. And so
is that the plan for levels to drop tonight?
That's the hope. And the models they have a hard time with the smoke because weather models don't typically see smoke in it. So it really changes what the cycles are doing. And sometimes it doesn't always go according to plan. But we're forecasting that the levels can drop tonight. And so, to get back to the question on the masks, I think if you feel comfortable wearing the mask, it's definitely great and effective, but it has to be the right type of mask. It has to be N95 or greater rating. So a regular dust mask won't really do the trick.
N95 or greater, because
mm-hmm.
so the particulates in our air are
because these are really small
so
particles.
Fine.
They go to the deepest part of your lungs and they cause a number of inflammation, other responses.
It's also important to remember that when you're using one of these N95 masks, you really have to do a couple things. One, make sure the mask is fitting you extremely well so that you're not getting flow in from the sides that's avoiding the mask. Secondly, if the mask does start to get to be hard to breathe through, you want to replace it with a new one.
Okay. And what else? You and I were talking before we opened our microphones about a room air filter, and you say that actually works.
Yeah, we have actually even made some homemade versions. You can take a MERV 13 or higher grade filter, you put it on a box fan, and you just plug it in, close your windows, let the fan run, and actually will clear it out. Depending on the size of the room, it could be anywhere from 15 minutes to an hour if you have a bigger room. And, you know, I've seen levels go down by 90%, and so it's really effective.
You're turning it in toward the room and blowing the air around, or you're sucking the air through the filter?
Right, you're sucking the air through the filter, yeah. And you keep it just in the middle of your room, and it's an effective tool.
It's just circulating all the air in your room through the filter. It doesn't have to be sucking in outside air, for example.
I see.
But just conditioning the air that's already there.
Right. And then, you know, there's commercial-grade equipment if you can get to a store and afford that kind of option. That's really effective, too.
I see on Facebook, listener Nicole is saying, my 8-year-old son is a singer in the Northwest Boy Choir and Vocal Point, Seattle, and his beautiful little voice is now sore. Quote, I couldn't hit the high notes today. Why, Mama? End quote. Smoke affecting people's throats? Question mark.
Well, yeah, children are certainly more impacted. They are smaller, so the body weight ratio versus what they're breathing is significant, and they have a higher breathing rate. Typically, they're more active. Maybe they're actively singing, for example, here, and so it can have definitely more impacts on the children, and then plus they're in development, and so that can have other impacts for the longer term, potentially.
As for what to do about it, Sim, we talked about fire suppression and controlled burns. If we want to prevent smoky skies like this or its causes, is there anything else that we should be talking about? And is this visible, is all this smoke changing that debate, do you think, about what we're willing to do?
Well, I do think that you know, we've seen changes in public perception about smoke. If you look in the media these days, there's actually a number of articles about people talking about smoke. So I think awareness is very large. I believe that the first step we need to do is find ways to protect our impacted populations, take care of each other, take care of those that are most likely to be affected, and really develop community response plans to deal with smoke when it occurs, to make it less of an issue for that community. And there are communities across the Northwest that have been doing this. Eric's agency and others have been dealing with communities trying to develop these type of responses. Getting people informed, shows like this, but also the Washington State Smoke blog that people can go to, wasmoke.blogspot.com.
wasmoke.blogspot.com.
Yeah, it's a great starting point to keep yourself informed about what's going to be happening with smoke in this state, and sort of trying to mitigate your own exposure. In terms of trying to reduce smoke levels overall, that's a very tough problem. This issue of, built up fuels on the ground about, climate starting to change, these things took decades to create. They're not going to go away overnight. And so we can certainly do things to try and start down a path that will help mitigate these in the future, but there's no silver bullet to get rid of the smoke in the near term.
Sim Larkin is a research meteorologist for the U.S. Forest Service based in Seattle and from the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency. We've also had Eric Saganich with us, and we're hoping this blows over, but that the bigger issues linger on for us to tackle. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. We're going to see if we can get clear on where the Seattle Mariners are headed in just a moment. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Which way are the Seattle Mariners headed? Their star shortstop got suspended, but then they bloomed, but then they withered. And their most famous starting pitcher was done. But then a little winning streak, and that star shortstop is coming back for now. My next guest must be dizzy following this team. Seattle Times columnist Matt Calkins. Matt, good to talk with you again.
You too, Bill. How are you?
Good, thank you. Let's start with the suspended shortstop coming back, Robinson Cano. Will you remind us why he got benched for, what, 3 months or so?
Yeah, he's the second baseman, just for clarity.
Oh, sorry, second baseman.
Yeah, no, all good. You know, right there in the infield.
Yeah,
he got suspended because he took a diuretic, which basically served as a masking agent for any substance he may have been taking. So they didn't catch him with a specific steroid or anything like that, but they caught him taking a masking agent. So he got 80 games. It broke the Major League Baseball's drug policy. And so he was out for half the season. He's coming back today. He's the guy that with a $240 million contract. He was playing great before he went down. So fans are hoping that he's the panacea for the recent skid. I don't know if he can quite live up to that, but it's certainly a little jolt that they need right now.
You said Robinson Cano was playing great before he went down, but do you think he was juicing before he went down and maybe for years before he went down?
I was going to say that's the million-dollar question. That might be the $240 million question.
Yeah.
Is how much that affected him before. You know, we've seen guys come back from PED suspensions and play great. I think Nelson Cruz is probably the prime example. He's been the Mariners' best power hitter for a while now, hitting 40 home runs, on pace to do it for 4 years in a row. He went down for a PED suspension in Texas and came back great. So we're going to see. You know, the guy's 35 years old. In baseball terms, that's getting up there, you know, towards the twilight of his career. So, whether he can play at the Robinson Cano level that everybody's used to is the question right now. But I do think he, no matter what, whether he was juicing and that was helping his performance, I think no matter what, him coming back is something that they do need. And that's what fans are getting excited right now.
Well, fans were excited for years and years, more than a decade, over the star Felix Hernandez. And
yes,
the Mariners have yanked him from the starting rotation, the end of an era. Are the team or the fans second-guessing that in any way?
I don't think so right now. Not only have they yanked him from the starting rotation, they put him in the bullpen and haven't used him since they did that. So I don't think there's a lot of confidence in him right now. You know, his ERA is at 5.73. It's the worst of his career. It's kind of in the territory of the among the worst among starting pitchers in Major League Baseball right now. And the thing is not only has he lost velocity on his fastball, he used to throw 98, when he was a kid, and just winning the Cy Young Award and really being the best pitcher in the American League. Now it's down to 89, and not only is it slower, but he's not able to locate his pitches right now. So he can't put it where he wants to, and so that is disallowing him from using his changeup, which really was his key pitch when he was the true king of the American League pitchers right now. You can tell he's frustrated. I'm not sure how many people saw the post-game interview he had after he gave up 11 runs in his last start, but I've never seen him more down. That's the sort of testimony from everybody around him. It's like, this guy's just quiet. This guy used to just have this attitude in the locker room, this energy about him, and that's gone. And so it's really weighing on him, and it's hard for the fans to see it, but I do think at this point a change was necessary, unfortunately.
All right, well, that would be a heck of a story if he was so frustrated and prideful that he just clawed his way back and got crafty and wily and all those veteran terms, and he reemerged just in time
especially if they finally made the playoffs and he was able to play a role in that. I think that's kind of the tragedy in all this, is if they do make the playoffs, something he's been waiting his whole career for, he might not be a part of that, and that's hard for a lot of fans to stomach.
Yes. Finally, Matt Calkins from Seattle Times, your paper's reported on a couple public stadium finance insiders saying King County could be about to enter a lease deal for Safeco Field that would be great for the Mariners, terrible for taxpayers. Why are they saying that briefly?
Yeah, well, right now, you know, the Mariners have negotiated a deal or in the final stages of negotiating where at this point they'd pony up between about $600 to $800 million, and the taxpayers would be on the hook for $180 million over 25 years in their new lease. And there are members of the King County Council who were saying, you know, you should be taking this from taxpayers. John Stanton, the Mariners chairman, is worth, you know, over $1 billion. The franchise is worth $1.4 billion. Why can't you do this yourself, especially with the homeless crisis going on? You know, it's a complicated issue. You know, I think they remember it's easy to say, oh, well, they can put it towards other things, and I get that. But this is something that goes on in a lot of cities as well. That doesn't necessarily mean it's right. A lot of cities are willing to finance their sports teams or subsidize them to a certain extent. And so that's kind of the battle right now. The Mariners side is, well, hey, listen, not only do other cities do this, but it's a publicly owned facility. And, you know, basically the city is the landlord, and you know, we think you guys should pony up a little money. And the county is saying, well, no, you guys can do this yourself. So the question is, should public money ever go towards sports teams? And also, you got to realize this would be coming, I think, from the hotel motel tax. So it wouldn't be Seattle taxpayers itself. It's a complicated issue. I mean, there's arguments for both sides, but that's kind of what's going on right now. And there's a judge right now that said, hey, listen, this policy has been too favorable toward the Mariners for too long. We know we need to take another look at this. So we'll see what happens in the next month or two. It's definitely a hot button issue right now. I'm interested to see what happens, and I get both sides of the argument, so we'll see.
Seattle Times columnist Matt Calkins following the Mariners along with you. Mariners are now 2.5 games behind Oakland with two more to play against Oakland, so they could end up this series just a half a game back, or
yep,
maybe 4.5 back.
Biggest series of the year
The biggest series of the year happening right now. Matt, thank you.
Hey, thanks a lot, Bill. I appreciate it.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle, and you're about to meet the Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer, Caroline Fraser, from Mercer Island, by the way. She's just written about Laura Ingalls Wilder and reconsidering the Little House on the Prairie series. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. A new Pulitzer Prize-winning book has me thinking about why I loved the Little House on the Prairie books as much as I did as a child. I knew they were comforting, with blazing hearths and bedtime fiddling and a family's love that was more powerful than locusts and blizzards and prairie fires. But I've been realizing how comforting they were to me on another level. They retold the myth of American self-reliance and righteousness. And I think on some level, I was comforted knowing I was part of that story. Well, why? Because of my own European ancestry, my light skin? What do you do with a series like Little House on the Prairie? This is a dilemma that Caroline Fraser understands. She grapples with it in her book, Prairie Fires, telling the story of Laura Ingalls Wilder. She says she believes Laura's books and life are more relevant than ever today, but for different reasons.
Because I think we just need to confront our history and our myths, our mythology about how we got here, especially if we're the children of white immigrants and white settlers, which I am.
Yeah, in fact, your ancestors were farmers in the upper Midwest, right?
That's right. Yeah, they all were farming around the turn of the century in Minnesota, in the Dakotas, in Wisconsin.
Same areas.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that where Laura Ingalls Wilder grew up?
Right. And had many of the same experiences. And one of the funny things I remember as a kid, when I discovered the books and loved them, you know, was talking to one of my grandmothers about them. And her response, you know, when I remember showing her an illustration, one of those Garth Williams illustrations from the books.
The famous ones,
yeah,
from those books.
Which are so sweet and, and as you say, comforting. And her response was really took me aback because she was a little bit scathing. You know, she was like, oh, that's not really how it was. It was really, you know, hard. And, you know, she talked a lot about just what hard work it was from, you know, the moment they got up to the moment they went to bed. They were just, you know, I mean, she came from a huge immigrant family of like 16 kids. And I think her life was taking care of her younger siblings and making bread and, you know, feeding the Weyerhaeuser lumbermen. You know, so it was just a kind of constant struggle.
But we think of these books as being about struggle and hardship and hard work, but yet they didn't tell the whole story.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the ways that the books were framed, and this was quite deliberate on Wilder's part, was as kind of soothing and uplifting and comforting stories that all had a happy ending. You know, yeah. I mean, if you read the books as an adult, you see how insistent she was at bringing everything to a kind of happy conclusion, even though there are quite dark moments and dark chapters in the books, that they do all come to that sort of wonderful, sweet conclusion.
Oh, yes. Did Laura Ingalls Wilder mean to spread the American myth that I referred to, the courage and the self-reliance at the expense of the people who were living here? I mean, did she mean to be a part of that myth-making, or was she just eulogizing a loving father or just selling books?
Well, I think that her desire to emphasize her parents' values was uppermost in her mind. She spoke of this quite often and said, you know, she wanted to memorialize them and have everybody know those American values of honesty and integrity and self-reliance. And I think that to an extent that she probably didn't even realize, she did edit out a lot of her, especially her father's struggles in terms of, you know, his failures as a businessman and a farmer. You know, she really wanted to cast him in the best possible light. And so she left out a lot of stuff that would have, you know, suggested that the farming enterprise was a lot more complicated. And so you are left with this sense that homesteading was a big triumph.
Yeah. And there's so many, man, there's so many levels to that. So for one thing, his values, honesty, integrity, self-reliance. Well, much as I loved that family and that man from these stories, that's kind of BS in a bigger picture, right? Honesty, integrity, self-reliance. So how aware, do you agree with that? And how aware was Laura Ingalls Wilder of that?
It was a lot more complicated. You know, her father was more complicated than she was willing to show in the books, although I think she was well aware of his shortcomings. She admitted in a letter to her daughter, Rose, some years later, you know, she wrote that, yes, Pa was no businessman. He was really a poet and a trapper. You know, she was very willing to make excuses for him that she wouldn't make for anybody else. I think that she probably wasn't all that conscious of those wider nuances, the whole idea that that white settlers were doing something that was appropriating others' land and forcing people off their land. And, you know, I mean, she was very much of the time and very, I think, accepting of the whole American project of Manifest Destiny in many ways. And yet there are moments in the books, especially at the end of, you know, Little House on the Prairie, where she's watching the Indians ride away, you know, off of their land. And she has that, she projects that nostalgia and kind of sentimentalized sorrow at what she's seeing. And yet she herself is part of the whole, you know, appropriation, because, you know, famously in that scene at the end, she points at an Indian baby and says, "Pa, get me that Indian baby." Yeah. And this was her actual memory. That was really something that she remembered happening. And it's such a vivid image of how white settlers were eager to appropriate not just the land, but everything else that belonged to the Indians, including their culture and their songs and their legends. And I don't think she thought about that in a real analytical or intellectual way.
And the other part of the big picture that you mentioned is that she edited out how hard it was, how much failing her family and her father actually did. And that that's significant because these so-called settlers were trying to do a kind of farming that didn't make any sense in some ways. They were misusing the land. Was Laura Ingalls Wilder, as she was writing and leaving out some of those land management struggles, was that just to sell books, or was she trying to downplay the, in some ways, folly of that westward expansion, the way it was working out?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that she and other people of her time were aware of what was happening when they went further west out onto the Great Plains, for example. You know, she and her family were part of that Dakota boom in the 1870s and 80s. They went out there in 1879, and they were really passing beyond the areas of good grass and good water from Minnesota into an area with much more variable precipitation, and they didn't know anything about that. Now, there were people who knew about that. People in the federal government knew it. People who worked for the railroads knew it, and in fact had been warned, you know, by John Wesley Powell and other scientists that this was going to be a big problem if they encouraged this mass migration of settlers into the Great Plains, because it just could not support the level of agriculture that they were used to. But that didn't filter down deliberately. And, you know, people were told that rain follows the plow, which, of course, it did not.
Not actually true.
Yeah. And so, you know, they were set up for failure. And she really, I think, had no way of knowing that. Although it's interesting to see what she later says about seeing what has happened to the Great Plains. She saw in the 1920s, you know, this whole movement of suitcase farmers, as they were called, you know, people who didn't really know anything about farming, but went out and tried to do, you know, grow wheat and make a quick buck, you know, in the southern Great Plains. And she saw the damage that was doing. And so in some way, I think she was aware in a kind of a generalized way of the ecological damage that could be done.
My guest is Caroline Fraser, and the book, the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography, is called Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder. And here we've been focusing on some of the negative parts of this legacy, I guess because I'm setting that against how much I adored these books as a child. And maybe we should say, let's honor the value. There's got to be value in that storytelling, in the reading it got so many people to do. What to you is the value of Laura Ingalls Wilder's work?
Well, I think you still can read the books as a kid and experience so much of what's, you know, wonderful about them. They're one of our great kind of paeans to the American family, you know, to the closeness and the ways in which family members can rely on each other in natural disasters and even in despair, you know, moments when people are, you know, failing all around them economically and they're really facing tough times, they draw together. And it's a wonderful portrait of that. It's one of the few portraits of a great father in children's
yes.
literature.
That's right. There's so many bad dads
yes.
in literature.
Yes. So I think it's still very enjoyable on those levels, although I think it's hard to maybe teach the books in the way that they were once taught in schools, kind of uncritically, because there are some racial stereotypes and language that has to be kind of unpacked for kids in a way that teachers didn't used to do. So I think they're totally enjoyable on that level, but I also think that they remain really relevant to people today in terms of seeing the way that they reflect the times. And, you know, that when you read them as an adult, you really do start to question a lot of the myths that we have about homesteading and farming. And
what do you mean? What's a myth that you questioned?
Well, I think that we have a sense that the whole project of Manifest Destiny, even though we have realized that the racial component of that doctrine was...
It was the doctrine of, it's like we, this is our God-given destiny, and we deserve to take this land.
Right. You know, even though we now question it, I think that there is a kind of unquestioning assumption that we were successful in taking this land and making it bear fruit, when in fact it's much more complicated than that. And much of what was done under the aegis of the Homestead Act was not a success. A lot of homesteaders washed out, did not succeed. A lot of the Great Plains were damaged. A lot of the West was damaged by what we did. So I think that we really can benefit from taking a look at these kind of unquestioning, you know, assumptions about what we did to the West and seeing how complicated it was, not just for farmers at that time, but farmers now. You know, I mean, independent farming now suffers from many of the same issues and problems that faced homesteaders then.
Yeah, but that doesn't sound like kid stuff. I think I was reading these books when I was, I don't know, 8 years old.
Sure.
And I think my memory is that it was mostly just on my own up in my bedroom. I wasn't mm-hmm. bouncing this off my parents, much less a teacher.
Yeah.
And Laura Ingalls Wilder chose to write these books mm-hmm. for a young audience.
Oh, sure. I just think that the Little House books have, in many ways, like Mark Twain's books, mm-hmm. you know, which were originally written for children. I think that they have passed beyond that and that the audience for them now is much wider. So when I talk about these issues, you know, about farming and agriculture and the ecology of the Great Plains, I'm talking about people who are really looking at these books as a kind of reflection of history, adult readers.
Would you give your, I've got 8-year-olds, you know, like, would you give this book to kids, knowing that mostly it's not going to get a critical theory treatment?
Sure, if they were interested in them as stories. I mean, they're great adventure stories. They're and they still have all of those values that she talked about. And I think kids are now so much more sophisticated in their response to things. I think I have heard about kids reading them who immediately question, you know, the stereotypes, for example, and say, you know, what was this about? You know, why is she saying the only good Indian is a dead Indian?
Yeah.
You know,
that's what the neighbor, I think her neighbor said, right? But you read it and I remember that phrase and I didn't, mm-hmm. I think the little girl was saying that she doesn't feel that way.
Right.
But still, when the whole backdrop is that the myth here is righteousness, I think that was damaging in a way for me to read.
And I think that is a question that every, you know, parent or every teacher or librarian has to kind of grapple with, you know, that you need to create some kind of context for kids in which to read these books. How you do that, I don't know. I'm not a teacher myself. But I actually think it's really important because all literature of a period prior to our own has these same issues. Virtually everything that you read from the 19th century contains these issues, or the 18th century or whatever. So you're going to have to grapple with it at some point. It's not like Little House on the Prairie is the only example of this. I mean, look at Huckleberry Finn.
Yeah. Do you ever think maybe grade school kids just shouldn't read old books?
You know, I think that's something that every school is going to have to deal with. And this is what came up, you know, a few weeks ago with the American Library Association.
Yeah, they changed the name of the Laura Ingalls Wilder Award.
Right. And I totally understand why they did that. I mean, that is an issue that I think has been coming up for them as librarians for years now. You know, they've had parents and kids and teachers, you know, saying, what about this? You know, maybe we need to make the name of our award, you know, a more inclusive title and really kind of shift the focus. I understand why they did that.
What would you have done? You're the head of the American Library Association for now. What do you do?
I think I probably would have done the same thing. And it's a hard issue for a lot of people because I think that knee-jerk reaction has been to interpret that as some form of censorship. But they released a statement that said quite unequivocally that they did not want to censor. They did not want to encourage people to not read Wilder's books, that they were merely trying to make an honor, an award that they give out, inclusive and welcoming to everybody, because they have to serve children from every community.
How do you hope we're remembering and talking about Little House on the Prairie in another 50, 100 years? You hope it's in the canon?
I do, for the same reason that I hope that, Little Women and... Mark Twain's books and other great children's classics of the period remain read and understood for what they are. Obviously they all have limitations and there are things about them that are, completely startling to a modern sensibility. But that's important. It's important to remember where we came from and why we became the people that we did, one of the things I was so startled by in writing this book was reading, the political rhetoric of the 1930s that was so much a factor when Wilder was writing these books, because she, became a real opponent of the New Deal. And you read what was said about Roosevelt at that time and the New Deal and how, farmers kind of hated all these relief programs. And it reads like something, that was printed in the newspaper yesterday. And a lot of the things that kind of seep through a little bit in terms of the patriotic insistence on self-reliance in the Little House books are very similar to issues we're facing now about, the anger about government programs and reliance on the government. It's important to know that we're still dealing with these same issues, decades later. I mean, we haven't progressed maybe as much as we like to think that we have. And I think books like this can help us understand that.
Caroline Fraser, the book is Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder. It's a pleasure.
Thank you very much. It was great.
Good to have you along on KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Magazine features on female celebrities often check a few boxes. What were they wearing? What were they eating? Are they a feminist?
Feminist, a person who believes in the social, political, and economic equality of the sexes.
You wake up
flawless,
housed up
flawless, flawless.
That's Beyoncé Giselle Knowles, whose feminism has been a hot topic of debate over the years. And also, you may have heard the voice of Eula Scott Bino. Mm-hmm. Hi, Eula.
Hey,
nice
y'all.
To see you.
Hi, Seattle.
Co-host of KUOW's Battle Tactics for Your Sexist Workplace. And your most recent episode is about Beyoncé as a feminist.
Absolutely.
I'm not quite part of the Beehive, Eula, so I know you can tell us a little more about the Queen. What was the controversy about Beyoncé's feminism or not in the first place?
Yeah, so I think a lot of people put feminism into this real small box and you have to fit all of the things to be able to really, put yourself in that space. And Beyoncé stands outside of that box in so many ways. She sings and performs a lot about her trials and tribulations and being in a heterosexual relationship and the hardship that her partner, her husband today, has placed on her life. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people kind of think that it's not appropriate to have so many issues with men and still consider yourself to be a feminist.
Yeah, I remember that with Taylor Swift. She would get people say, why do you keep singing about your boyfriends?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
But how is it different for Beyonce, how it plays out in Beyonce's?
I think for Beyonce, she says she's a feminist. You know, Taylor Swift has kind of skirted away from that conversation a bit, where a lot of celebrities have. And it's interesting because Beyonce saying, no matter how you might view my relationships with men, that doesn't take anything away from my feelings towards the equality of women.
And when we talk about there's like a debate, there's someone you quote in your episode, Bell Hooks, coming out and saying some pretty strong words.
Yeah, she calls Beyonce a terrorist.
Yeah, and an anti-feminist when it comes to young women, I think. What does she mean by that?
I think she thinks it's because Beyonce's sexy that's anti-women in some ways. But as a woman, I am sexy, and I don't think that's the worst thing in the world. I think you're sexy. I think men are sexy. I think that we have the right to be these elements of ourselves and still say that equality should be, you know, equality should be fair and equal. But for bell hooks, it's like, but you can't be fair and equal if you're also wearing a leotard, which is not true.
Well, I am, unlike you, I'm old enough to have, I remember some of these debates from the 70s. There's been sort of a back and forth about the issue of the, what today we would call the male gaze, you know, sort of seeking that. And where do you stand on that?
I have a friend named Miguel who, I don't know if Miguel would ever listen to the show, but Miguel told me years ago.
It's 94.9 FM.
No, I know.
Listen to the
show. I don't
even
know where Miguel lives anymore.
Oh, okay.
This conversation was over 10 years ago, okay. But he said to me once, he said, what did he say? He said, women do not go out for the attention of men. Women don't get dressed for the attention of men. Women get dressed for the attention of other women's compliments.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, absolutely. Like, I don't know if I care what men think when I get out the door. Mm. I really, you know, Bree's like glance of approval really means a lot to me, way more than
you're talking about our social media producer, Bree Ripley, who's sitting next to me.
Yeah.
And what she thinks.
Well, because she sees me as a person. I know that first. She's not looking at me as any kind of an object to begin with. And so when she's complimenting my outfit, she's really saying that she sees and recognizes that I put myself together. And I think most women are really looking for the feel-good factor of a look way more than they're thinking about the male gaze.
Mm.
Yeah.
First of all, when we're talking about whether Beyonce is a feminist, maybe we should say, why does that matter so much to you that you devoted an episode of Battle Tactics for Your Sexist Workplace to that idea?
For me, it was really the first time I ever saw myself as a feminist, really.
What was the first time?
When I saw Beyonce announce on the VMAs in 2014 that she stood firmly in the role of feminist. Before that, I had only really seen the conversation be inclusive of white women and the way that feminism was meant to progress their agenda towards equality for, you know, all folks in white world. Versus, you know, the inclusivity of people like me who get dressed and hang out with and have a husband or a partner. And, you know, we fight over stuff. And maybe I'd write that in a song if I was as talented as Beyonce. And so it's interesting to think about it was my first time saying, well, Beyonce looks like me, has issues with men like me, probably goes out on week parties on the weekend like me. And she's a feminine. Oh, I can do that, too.
Eula, would you say a little more for those who are up on it of how you have felt left out, or if you want to talk about other people or yourself, about left out of feminism?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the sad part is this country has really figured out how to divide us in so many different pockets, right? And so men versus women is one of them, but also we have the breakdown of race playing a role as well. And so often women will kind of align themselves with their own race before they align themselves with their gender. And so it really creates a wall for us to be able to, you know, identify as being on the same team, right? Like it's hard for me to think about a feminist who, I mean, there are feminists who voted for Trump, right? Like they have to exist. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm kind of holding my head in a way of
it's like you have a headache.
This can't be real, mm-hmm. But they have to exist. But because for them, their liberation stands in the lane purely of women. And when they think women, they think white women who still have privileges some places. Where for me, when I think of feminism for all women, period. I want it to be intersectional and be inclusive.
Eula Scott Bino co-hosts the KUOW podcast, Battle Tactics for Your Sexist Workplace. And yes, she devotes an episode to Beyonce, and you play a clip from the song Boss.
My great-great-grandchildren already rich. That's a lot of brown turn on your Forbes list.
Reminding us how rich she is. Is that a feminist move?
I think so. I mean, this is a capitalist society, and it runs on money. And if you think you there's a way around it, you lied. You maybe live in a hut and you have, what's it called where your parents leave you money?
inheritance.
Yeah, you have a giant inheritance, and so you get to opt out of it. But for Beyonce, I mean, she's been working hard, and not like kinda. She's been working since she was a young girl. She was popular as a teenager already on the national stage, and she's one of the first artists to really put herself in a platform to be able to travel from stadium to stadium as a single woman, not with a bunch of names behind her or with a man standing next to her, but singularly. You know.
And your podcast is Battle Tactics for Your Sexist Workplace. Do you think Beyonce's wealth is inspiring to the rest of us workers, the 99%?
Yes, in some ways and in no. I mean, I want to be wealthy enough to support myself and my family. I don't need to be $350 million rich like Beyonce. But if she builds a compound and she needs help, I'm willing.
In your episode, the writer, attorney Ginger McKnight Chavers says that our pressure on women to be feminists can clip their wings. What do you think of that?
I totally agree. I think that the minute we put a box on a person and tell them the right way to be their best selves, then there's no way to get there, right? Because then if you're trying to constantly mold yourself in the right direction, you're never going to make it. One of my favorite clips is, it's on our Hella Black, Hella Seattle's Instagram. That's my other podcast, you guys. It's this young girl and she's just being asked to define a slut. And she just goes on and on in this great way of saying, you know, I'm a slut, your microphone's a slut, your mama's a slut. It's just because there's no way to, if we put a label on everything we do, there's just a million of them. Everybody is some version of someone else's bad time. Also, everyone is someone else's version of someone else's good time, right?
Eula Scott Bino, co-hosting the KUW podcast, Battle Tactics for Your Sexist Workplace. And you can hear the episode on Beyonce and all the other episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Will you come back soon?
Absolutely. I'd love to.
Eula Scott Bino, thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for tuning into The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke, and the show is produced by Aman Al-Sadi, Ajua Jimma-Brempong, Allison Bruzek, Sophie Reed, and Jason Pagano, social media producer whose opinion about skirts counts, Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. Talk to you tomorrow.